He faced Mungo St. John, holding his gaze steadily, both of them completely expressionless. "Gentlemen, I appeal to both of you to settle this affair without bloodshed." Zugo went through the ritual attempt at reconciliation. "Captain Codrington, as challenger, will you tender an apology?" Clinton shook his head once, curtly. "Mr. St. John, is there any other way in which we can avoid bloodshed?" "I think not, sir," St. John drawled, as he carefully tapped half an inch of grey ash from his cheroot. "Very well," Zugo nodded, and went on immediately to set the conditions of the meeting. "At the command proceed, each of you gentlemen will take 10 paces, which I will count aloud. Immediately after the count of 10, I will give the command, fire, upon which you will be at liberty to turn and discharge your weapon." Zugo paused and glanced at Tipu. There was a long-barreled, muzzle-loading pistol thrust into the waistband of his baggy breeches. "Both seconds are armed." Zugo laid his right hand on the butt of the Colt pistol in his own belt. "If either principal attempts to fire before the command to do so, then he will immediately be shot down by the seconds." He paused again, looking from one to the other. "Is that clearly understood, gentlemen?" They both nodded. "Do either of you have a question?" Zugo waited in silence for a few seconds and then went on. "Very well, we will proceed. Mr. St. John, you have first choice of weapon." Mungo St. John dropped the cheroot and ground it into the sand with his heel before stepping forward. Tipu offered him the rosewood case, and after a momentary hesitation, St. John lifted out one of the beautifully inlaid weapons. He pointed at the sky and cocked the hammer with a sweep of his free hand. Clinton took the remaining pistol and weighed it experimentally in his hand, settling the butt deeply into the V formed by thumb and forefinger. Turning half away and lifting the pistol at full stretch of his arm to aim it at one of the black and bright yellow bishop birds that chattered in the reeds nearby. With relief, Robin watched the familiar ease with which her champion handled the weapon, and she felt completely certain of the outcome now. Good must triumph, and she started to pray again, silently, only her lips moving as she recited the 23rd Psalm. "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death." "Take your positions, gentlemen." Zugo stepped back and gestured to Robin. Still praying, she hurried to where Zugo stood, and fell in a few paces behind him, well out on the flank from the lines of fire of the two principals. Beside Zuga, Tipu drew the long, clumsy-looking pistol from the sash around his waist and cocked the big, ornate hammer. The bore of the barrel gaped like a cannon as he lifted it into the present position. Zuga drew his own Colt revolver and stood quietly while the two principals walked the last few paces towards each other and then turned back to back. Beyond them, the early sun was gilding the hilltops with bright gold, but leaving the lagoon still in shadow, so the still dark waters steamed with wisps of mist. In the silence, a ghostly grey heron croaked hoarsely, and then launched into flight from the edge of the reed bank with slow wing beats, its neck drawn back into a snake-like S to balance the long beak. "Proceed," called Zuga, so loudly that Robin started violently. The two men stepped out, away from each other, with deliberate strides, heeling heavily in the yielding sand, pacing to the count that Zuga called. "Five!" Mungo St. John was smiling softly, as though at some secret joke, and his white silk sleeve fluttered like a moth's wing around the uplifted arm that held the slim steel-blue barrel pointed at the dawn sky. "Six!" Clinton leaned forward, stepping out with long legs clad in white uniform breeches. His face was set, pale as a mask, his lips drawn into a thin, determined line. "Seven!" Robin felt the beat of her heart crescendo, thumping painfully against the cage of her ribs so that she could not breathe. "Eight!" She noticed for the first time the patches of sweat that had soaked through the armpits of Clinton's white shirt, despite the chill of the dawn air. "Nine!" Suddenly she was deadly afraid for him. All her faith dissolved in a sudden premonition of disaster rushing down upon her. "10!" She wanted to scream to them to stop. She wanted to rush forward and throw herself into the space between the two men. She didn't want them to die, either of them. She tried to fill her lungs, but her throat was closed and dry. She tried to drive her legs forward, but they were locked rigidly under her, beyond her control. "Fire!" shouted Zuger, his voice cracking with the tension that gripped all the watchers. And out on the damp, dark yellow sand, both men turned like a pair of dancers in a meticulously rehearsed ballet of death. Their right arms outflung towards each other in a gesture like that of parted lovers, the left hand on the hip to balance, the classic stance of the expert marksman. Time seemed suspended. The movements of the two men graceful but measured, without the urgency of onrushing death. The silence was complete. There was no wind to rustle the reeds, no bird nor animal called from the looming forest across the lagoon. The footfalls of the two men were deadened by the yielding sand. The world seemed to hold its breath. And then the crash of pistol fire awoke the echoes and sent them bounding and booming across the gorge, leaping from cliff to cliff, startling the birds into raucous flight. The two shots were within 1/100th of a second of each other, so that they blended into a single blurt of sound. From the levelling blue barrels, the dead white powder smoke spurted, and then the barrels were flung upwards in unison with the shock of discharge. Both men reeled backwards, keeping their feet. But Robin had seen the smoke fly from the muzzle of Mungo St. John's pistol a fraction of a second earlier, and then an instant later, Mungo's big, dark head flinched as though he had been struck with an open hand across the cheek. After that one staggered pace backwards, he steadied, drawing himself to his full height, the pistol still smoking in his raised hand, staring at his adversary. And Robin felt a rush of relief. Mungo St. John was unscathed. She wanted to run to him. And then suddenly the joy withered. A dark red snake of blood slithered from the thick hair at his temple down the smoothly shaven olive skin of his cheek and dripped with slow, sullen drops onto the white silk of his shirt. She lifted her hand to her mouth to cover the cry that rose within her, and then her attention was distracted by another movement in the corner of her vision, and she swung her head with a jerky movement towards Clinton Codrington. He also had been standing erect, with almost military bearing, but now he began to bow slowly forward at the waist. The right hand holding the pistol hung at his side, and now his fingers opened and the ornate weapon dropped into the sand at his feet. He lifted the empty hand and placed it across his chest, with fingers outspread, in a gesture that seemed reverential, and slowly his body bent forward, and now his legs gave way under him, and he dropped to his knees as though in prayer. Kneeling, he lifted his hand away from his chest and examined with an expression of mild surprise the small smear of blood that coated his fingers, and then he pitched forward face down onto the sand. At last Robin could move. She raced forward and dropped to her knees beside Clinton's fallen body, and with strength of panic rolled him onto his back. The front of the white linen shirt was damp with a little blood around the neat puncture in the cloth, 6 inches to the left of the line of mother-of-pearl buttons. He had been half-turned to fire, and the ball had taken him low and left, at the level of the lungs. She saw instantly the lungs. She felt despair overwhelm her. It would mean death, no less certain, because it was slow and agonizing. She would have to watch this man drown inexorably in his own blood. Sand crunched beside her, and she looked up. Mungo St. John stood over her, his shirt a mess of wet blood. He was holding a silk kerchief to his temple to staunch the copious flow where the pistol ball had stripped a long ribbon of scalp off his skull above the ear. His eyes were bleak, his expression forbidding, and his voice cold and distant as he told her quietly, "I trust you will be satisfied at last, madam." Then he turned abruptly up the white dune towards the beach. She wanted to run after him, to restrain him, to explain she knew not what. But her duty was here with the man more gravely stricken. Her fingers shook as she unbuttoned the front of Clinton's shirt and saw the dark blue hole punched into the pale flesh from which a little thick, slow blood oozed. So little blood at the mouth of the wound. It was the worst indication. The bleeding would be inside, deep inside the chest cavity. "Zuga, my bag," she called sharply. Zuga came to her, carrying the bag, and went down on one knee beside her. "I am but lightly struck," murmured Clinton. "I have no pain, just a feeling of numbness here." Zuga did not reply. He had seen a multitude of gunshot wounds in India. Pain was no indication of the severity. A ball through the hand or foot was unbearable agony. Another through both lungs was only mildly discomforting. Only one thing puzzled him, and that was why Mungo St. John's shot had been so wide. At 20 paces, he would surely have taken the head shot, aiming between the eyes with an expectation of the ball deviating less than an inch from the point of aim. Yet the shot had taken Clinton low in the chest. While Robin pressed a dressing over the wicked little blue mouth of the wound, Zuga picked the pistol out of the sand. The barrel was still warm, and there was the peppery whiff of burned powder as he examined it and saw instantly why Mungo's shot had struck wide. There was a bluish smear of bright new lead on the steel trigger guard. Mungo St. John had indeed aimed at the head. But Clinton had lifted the pistol to his eye at the same instant directly in the line of the sight. St. John's ball had struck the metal guard and been deflected downwards. That would account for the fact that Clinton's own ball had been high. For, as a less expert marksman, he would surely have aimed for St. John's chest. The strike of the ball had thrown his weapon upwards at the moment of discharge. Zuga looked up and handed the pistol to Tipu, who waited impassively, close at hand. Without a word, Tipu took the weapon, turned away, and followed his master over the dunes. By the time 4 seamen from the gunboat could carry Clinton Codrington down the beach, using his boat cloak as a hammock, St. John was climbing up from the Huron's whaler onto his main deck, and before they could rig a block and tackle to lift the prostrate form of her captain into Black Joke, Huron had broken out her anchor and was spreading sail before the southwesterly breeze and bearing away with the sunrise, transforming her into a vessel etched in golden fire. For 24 hours, Clinton Codrington surprised Robin with the strength of his recovery. She looked to see blood on his lips, and she expected him to experience the agony of breathing as the damaged lung collapsed. Every few hours she listened with her sounding trumpet to his chest, stooping over the bunk in his cabin to catch the hiss and soar of his breathing, listening for the bubbling sound of blood or for the dry bubbling of the lung against the ribcage, and was puzzled when none of these symptoms occurred. Indeed, Clinton was unaccountably resilient for a patient with ball through the chest cavity. He complained only of stiffness reaching up into his left armpit and semi-paralysis of that arm. And he was vociferous in his advice to his surgeon. "You will bleed me, of course," he asked. "I will not," Robin told him shortly, as she cleaned the area around the wound and then lifted him into a sitting position to bandage his chest. "You should take at least a pint," Clinton insisted. "Have you not bled enough?" Robin asked witheringly. But he was undaunted. "There is black rotten blood that must be taken off." Clinton indicated the massive bruise that was spreading around his chest like some dark parasitic plant around the smooth, pale trunk. "You must bleed me," Clinton insisted. For all his adult life, he had been exposed to the ministrations of naval surgeons. "If you don't, fever is sure to follow."